Anita, how's your mental health?
Questionable at all times, you know this.
Yeah, how's the mental health of your children?
Also a little bit tricky. Can I tell you my experience in trying to find therapists for myself and my kids, Mel?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is how it goes. You ask around your friends and your family for a referral for somebody who's nearby. You finally find somebody who sounds like they might work for your family. You give them a call and you find out that A, they're not accepting new patients, or B, they have a huge wait list. So you start over again and you ask people if they know anybody who would be a good therapist and a good fit. Finally, you find one, you go and you meet with them, and you figure out that you don't actually like them that much. But it's been so much work to find somebody who you can go to in your area that you're kind of stuck with them. Well, do you have any ideas for how to get around this?
I do because guess what? I've actually had some therapists that I have found on my own, which involves what you're saying. Sometimes I remember one time I was like 3 hours in the bathtub on my phone looking through websites. I was such a prune at the end. But I have also had the experience with working with BetterHelp, and it was like I don't want to say too good to be true, but because it is true, but it's like amazing because I was matched with my therapist within 24 hours.
And you didn't have to go through all of that other ridiculous process of trying to find somebody. And here's the cool thing, too, is if that person didn't work out for you, you can just switch and say, and it's not like you're committing to another years long search for somebody who you're going to jive with.
That's true. And I lucked out, or maybe just BetterHelp is really good at matching people together because I never had to change my therapist. I loved her, perfect fit for me. And I know that some of our friends have used BetterHelp and they've had to change therapists, and boom, same day, you can change.
Easy
You can ghost your therapist, get a
peasy.
new one.
I love this idea. BetterHelp is one of our sponsors. If you use our promo code trybetterhelp.com/WWDN, you get 10% off your first month, and we totally recommend it.
Yes, get some therapy. That's
Ha.
trybetterhelp.com/WWDN. Arr, matey. Oh,
Arr.
wait, that was last week.
Once a pirate, always a pirate. Don't they say that?
Probably, and a yo ho ho.
Pirate's life for me. Hey, Mel.
Anita, I'm dying.
Me too.
Okay, great. It cancels out.
But for stupid reasons, I just have a kink in my neck from sleeping funny last night. And so, you know how that's super annoying when you realize that your neck is supposed to turn and it won't turn? Yeah. So, not really dying.
No, fake dying. I'm also fake dying because I got awakened at 4 in the morning with a migraine, and now my whole body hurts. But I'm fine.
Isn't that a ripoff that you wake up to be in pain? Shouldn't your body just stay asleep?
Yeah, that's how you
Yeah.
know I'm not making it up, is when it bolts you out of a dead sleep.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
Can we tell everybody how we had so much fun last weekend?
We had so much fun last weekend. Well,
So.
actually, okay. Actually, we did have so much fun. We invented our own game.
It was called Analog Wordle because both of our phones were dying and we were standing in lines. Oh, wait, we should back up and tell them where we were.
Okay, stop. So once upon a time, we got done with Camp Widow and we traveled to a faraway airport because the tickets were better for us. And behold, we visited nigh unto an adventure land.
Called, as my son calls it, University Studios. We went to Harry Potter Land at Universal Studios, and it was so fun.
I had so much fun, and I thought that I would not because people were there. And
A
I
lot.
had so much fun, I can't even explain. And Anita and I bonded even more. We made up our own games, and now you guys, we know that if the zombie apocalypse happens and the zombies eat all the electricity in time and space, we know how to keep ourselves entertained.
Yes, we invented the game called Analog Wordle, and it's because both of our phones were dying, and even our charger that I had in my bag wasn't working, and so we could not play with our phones. And so, you know the game Wordle, where you like
guess the letters. So we just did it. One of us would come up with the word and the other one would guess it. It was so hard.
It was hard. It made us so tired, but we had fun.
It was hard for both people, the person who came up with the word and the person guessing the word. Both hard.
Yeah. But you know what? It really makes 90-minute lines go faster.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, so we had a great time. And then guess what, Mel?
We went home.
Yeah, and re-entry this time was not so bad.
Ah, yes!
Yeah, I felt really... It was very strange. It's like I came home and there was a familiarity to the chaos and it didn't feel oppressive, I guess. It just felt kind of normal for me.
Anita, you told me something that I think you should share with the world because this is kind of a breakthrough for you.
Yeah. So one morning I was trying to get the kids off to school and they were not cooperating and I was feeling really frustrated with them, like I often do. And I think most parents can say that they often feel frustrated with their kids. But usually when I'm in that state, I go straight to Jason's dead. This wouldn't be happening if Jason weren't dead. You know, I'm a widow. This is awful. It's all his fault. Things like that. And instead, I had this just little tiny thought of, this is normal, and this would be happening even if you weren't a widow. And that sounds like a little change in how I think about things, but it felt kind of monumental because it was a shift towards, no, you know, you're okay. You can do this even if your kids are being annoying.
I'm so proud of you, Anita.
Yes.
I don't know if it was conscious or not, but whatever the reason, mm-hmm. I salute you.
Yeah, and then guess what happened the next day?
Something bad.
Yeah, it was Friday night, and I just wanted to go on a date.
With me?
Is that such a terrible thing? Well, sure, but really I wanted to go on a date with Jason. Oh. You know, I just miss being able to pick up and go for a date. You know what I'm saying? Not planning for the future, not asking what other people's plans are, not being the third wheel or the fourth wheel or, you know, going with friends. And I love my friends and I love my family and I love the people around me. But it's like, and I love Mel.
Thank you.
I love you, Mel. But I just want to go on a stupid date with Jason.
You could. You just have to go to the cemetery.
Yeah, I don't think he eats much these days, though, which is, like, cheaper.
Yeah, he's a cheap date. You get to do whatever you want because he won't care. He'll go along with any of it.
That's kind of how it was before, though. I'd be like, hey, I want to try this new restaurant. And he'd be like, okay, I want to go eat this. Oh, okay. So, yeah, I was really bummed about that. And it felt really sad for me. And then my kids were like, what's the matter? I'm like, I just want to go on a date with Dad. And they're like, we'll go on a date with you. And I was like, that's not the same thing at all. So there you go. That was my up and down and up and down of the week.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I was available Friday night.
Well, remember how we talked about the pickles?
Was that our date? We were texting about pickles.
No, we were going to go get the pickles.
Oh, yeah, we didn't. Okay, so this happened to me recently, and I am wondering if you can help me process it, because it hasn't happened for a while, because, mm-hmm. you know, I've kind of shrunk my circle to
nobody.
You. The dogs. And Emily Thornton, who came and did a photo shoot for me yesterday. Thanks, Emily.
Aw, jealous.
Yeah, I need some rebranding for my music site, so stay tuned, and then hire her. So this happened, and I feel so uncomfortable with it, and I don't know why people do this. If you're a kidless widow and you are of potentially childbearing age, I guess. I'm 39.
Could still happen, Mel.
Why do people assume that that's what you want right now when you don't have a person and you're like nearing the age of not having children? Why? I don't know how to say it eloquently. I just am like, why do people come up to me and say, oh, well, did you and your husband have kids? No. Well, are you going to have any? Do you want some? And I'm like, that's a really invasive question. Like, I always am like, why do people do that to me? It happens frequently when I don't keep in my shrunken circle.
So I have a question for you.
Okay.
Do you think it's uber sensitive for you because especially the society that you live in that's normal for people to want kids, and maybe you don't have the same desires that are seen as normal, and so you feel defensive about it?
Partially, yeah. But the thing that's so weird is this did not happen with anybody in my community. That's, I think,
it was a stranger.
A stranger, and it caught me off guard. And, yeah, I don't really know what to think about it. And another widow. So
interesting.
I don't know what that was about. But the way that it was asked was just like, I don't know. I find that people who are deep into religion are the only ones that ask that question to me ever. And the people that are like, go with the flow, whatever, nobody cares. Nobody asks.
So when we first started texting with each other and met each other, I'm pretty sure I asked you that fairly quickly also. And I wonder if that made you angry at me.
No, I don't think it did, because I think we were joking so much. But this was like a total stranger. And like the second thing out of their face was that.
The second thing out of their face. They were like, hi, my name is, do you want to have children?
Seriously.
See, this is, I don't think this is just a sensitive topic for widows, but maybe more sensitive because the choice has kind of been taken away from you. I guess when people are married and they didn't want kids, you can just be like, no, I didn't want kids. But people assume that you did want kids and that was taken away. And maybe you would have wanted to at some point in time, or maybe you wouldn't have, but you just didn't get the chance to play it out.
That's what's hard about it. It's like, of us kidless widows, so many wanted to and still want to. And that's part of their huge grief. And then there were some who did not want to, but they don't want to be asked about their uterus. Or there are those in both categories that just don't want to talk about it. I think that's me. I just don't want to talk about my uterus situation with a stranger.
It's sensitive both ways, it could be, right? Like, if you really wanted to have kids and you weren't able to, like, sad, that's really sad. Or maybe you didn't want to, and then you have feelings about people assuming that you want to. And then you're just like, I don't want to have this deep conversation with somebody who I don't even
know. Yeah, because I'm also like, I don't even know what I'm doing tomorrow. Why are you asking me this existential question that's like a life step right now? And I don't even know you.
You could just answer for tomorrow.
I'll be like, ask me tomorrow.
Not tomorrow.
I know.
Not in the next 9 months.
And it always catches me so off guard. And then I'm like, I need just a pre-planned answer that says I am not willing to talk about that, because I'm not.
Yeah.
And really, my personality in life is always go with the flow. So I'm like, okay, I'm sure if Scott and I had kept being married and he didn't die, you know, life unfolds, cool. But he died. And I know better than to plan out my life, obviously.
Yeah. It kind of sucks, too, because nobody ever asks me that question.
They're like, why do you have so many?
They don't really ask me that either. They just get a look in their eyes, a deer in headlights kind of a look.
Yeah.
But really, I don't have that many kids in the scheme of things. There's people with a lot more.
Yeah, like 12 and 7.
Yeah, exactly. Which we met some people last weekend who had that many children. Yeah. So
I really enjoy being around my widow friends, kidless or not, that are just there in the moment and they meet you where you are and nobody has to talk about anything like that. And I feel like all of our friends that we met at Camp Widow and that are in our Widow Wives Club that like we got to meet up with, it's always so comfortable. I feel like people are really good at reading the situation and knowing if they want to talk about it. Or like they'll talk about their own selves and what they wanted or want. Yeah. But there's not so much invasive stuff like that. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah.
I know you're not a kidless widow, but like I need you to process with me out loud.
I know, that's the
to
thing.
Everyone.
Like, I don't have this problem. No, I mean, I just think it's one of those things, we've talked about this before, that it's not really anybody's business, even if you have an alive partner or spouse, what you're going to do as far as having children. We've talked about that. And I think that that's also a topic that you probably leave to somebody who you have gotten to know really well and know if it's an appropriate thing to ask them or not. I also think that we ask a lot of questions of people that probably are a little bit tricky. Like for some people, they really don't like to be asked how their person died. But for you and I, it doesn't bother us at all.
It's right? Yeah, that's true.
But that's a potentially like question that people should not ask also. So
I know. I tried to read the room for that too. And sometimes I can tell that it's okay to ask. And sometimes I'm like, I get this feeling that's just like, just back off.
Sometimes we assume that unless we had a huge life insurance payout, we don't really need to know anything about investments or even finances. But guess what? A little knowledge of finances is critical for all of us. Maybe your partner was in charge of that stuff, and now you find yourself making all the decisions. Maybe you're mad about that. Maybe I am. Nicole from the He's Gone But the Money's Not podcast is here to help. She tackles financial literacy by telling the stories of women and widows and finance experts and shares the lessons they've learned as certified financial planners. Whether you know a lot and feel confident in your financial decisions or feel unsure about all of that stuff, there is more to learn. Listen and subscribe to the He's Gone But the Money's Not podcast on all podcast platforms. This ad was paid for by Rockhouse Financial, an SEC-registered investment advisor.
Yeah, I think that's just a part of life and trying to figure out how to interact with people. And I think you're right. I think that you probably need to come up with something in your own, because you can't control other people,
no,
obviously, and what they're going to say. And your tactic of just hiding from everybody is probably not a long-term solution.
No, because I had so much fun at Camp Widow, and then among all the people in Universal, I don't know what's going on with me.
Plus, when we hit the 3:30 p.m. mark and we watched all the parents having breakdowns and screaming at their kids, Mel was like, and this is why I don't want to have children. Even though those two things were not corrected. They weren't necessarily connected.
But then I also felt bad for them, because I was like, if Anita had her kids there, that would be her. And there was this one lady there that, like, her husband was in trouble. Like, it was scary. We were scared for ourselves,
it
too.
Was, yeah, it was entertaining because we weren't a part of it. So, yeah, Mel, I'm sorry that you run into that every so often and don't really appreciate that.
Oh, thanks. I mean, it's good in those instances to, like, look back and say, this happens frequently. I cannot change those people and what they say, but I can come up with some response. I just get thrown off.
Yeah. You're just like, what?
Okay, practice with me.
Okay. Hey, Mel. It's nice to meet you. My name's Anita.
Hi, Anita.
You have a dead husband?
I do.
Are you going to have kids? Are you going to get remarried? Are you dating yet?
I am not prepared to talk about that, and I just met you, but thank you for your concern.
Very nice. Or you could just, I feel like you could divert. You could be like, how about them Yankees?
Wait. Let's do another one.
Okay. Hey, I noticed that you're a widow. I just was wondering how your person died.
Oh, yeah. I'm a widow, and my husband died from hypoxia after a tonsillectomy and deviated septum surgery.
So do you guys have kids?
We don't have kids.
Are you going to get remarried so you can have kids? Do you want to have kids?
Are you going to get remarried? And do you want to have kids? And do you want to take care of my kids if I ever have them? And if the answer is not yes, then go away. Was that a good one? That was the best one.
Yeah. Then what if they're like, yes, I will. I'll be your nanny.
Oh, then I'll be like, I just met you. Okay, whatever. Okay.
Okay.
Guys, practice conversations with Mel and Anita. Our new segment. What's been bothering you? Let us know in the Widow Wives Club.
We can have those conversations. Yeah, we actually had some of those things flying around, like dumb things people said to each other or dumb things that people have said to them. And some of them were along those lines. So, yeah. Speaking of the Widow Wives Club, come check out the Widow Wives Club. It's a private Facebook group, really supportive, really amazing. We do make you provide proof that you're a widow or widower. And widow or widower means, that's a tricky sentence, means anybody who sustained partner loss, married, unmarried, engaged, same sex, complicated, whatever.
Like Anita said, it's on Facebook, so search for it and join it. It's the one that's called Widow We Do Now, the Widow Wives Club. It's a lot of words. It's also on our public Facebook page if you cannot find the link.
Okay, and if you guys are interested in keeping the podcast going, then check out our Patreon. It's patreon.com/WWDN. It's just a way to support content creators like podcasts. It takes a lot of work to keep this thing going.
And we do it with love in our hearts because...
otherwise we wouldn't do it.
Do it for the widows. Yeah. So in addition to helping support the podcast at the $5 per month level, if you would like to support us in increments above that, it helps us to get a babysitter for Anita's kids so she does not harm them. Kidding, nobody call the government on her. There are also some fun extras in there too. Behind the scenes, topic discussions, all sorts of things. And Anita's recent trip and first time ever, might I add, to Waffle House in the South.
It was good. I liked it.
Right? So check it out. Yes. There's a lot of stuff on there. It's patreon.com/WWDN.
Okay, we're going to start with our shout out with our secret dead husband.
And this is one of the perks that you get at the $10 level per month and up.
Okay, to her we say, she did it all for the widow, the widow.
Is that Eminem?
No.
What is that?
It's like, you did it all for the nookie, but we
oh my gosh, yeah. Kind of goes along with your date night. Anyway.
Yes.
Constance Dahlbeck.
David Kelly.
Don Satterwhite.
Gail Paxton.
Bell. Wait, maybe she wants us to call her Gail Bell.
Okay, Gail Bell.
That's her new secret last name. Ivan the Meisner.
Cat.
Great job on your presentation at Camp Widow Cat. Krista Waite.
Who's my mother, and I'm her fairy godmother. It's very complicated.
And daughter. Sorry about the skunk.
Sam Finlayson.
Amy Hartman Martell.
Amy Neal.
Amy Sapp.
Ashley Hahn.
Brittany Pedro.
Chris Steffen.
Christina Schifflet.
Danielle Katterberg.
Not a Debbie Downer.
Dennis Brozzo.
I got a fitted sheet out today and I thought of you, Dennis. Are you still alive? Please let us know. Heidi Hayward.
Jean Marie Massey.
Jenny Taylor.
She's famous. Jennifer Beal.
Jennifer Brown.
Jennifer E. Hassel.
Jenny Wang.
Kathy Marie.
Kelly Ford.
Kirsten Stromberg-Clausen.
Lauren Glassblower Old.
Leslie Webb.
Marie Hoffman.
M.K. Anderson.
Missy Schubert.
Patricia Weist.
How do you say your name? Weist? Weist? Weist?
Yeah.
Weist?
I don't know.
Tell us. Rachel Barbosa.
Sarah Morris.
Sue Golek.
Taylor Snyder.
Sylvia the Widow Shore.
The Winehouse Karen Cornejo.
The Widow of Kirchhoff. Vicky Spitt.
Anna Tracy.
Christina Scambato.
Christine Anderson.
Cindy Raynaud.
Don Barber.
Debbie Fells.
Deborah Westwood.
Deborah.
Deborah.
Diana Becker.
Emily Toledo.
Eric Vandermeulen.
Aaron Pozick, our secretary.
Gabe Lozano.
Gia Benoit.
Gina Haas. Hi.
Ian Cini.
Ileana Bell Ruiz.
Jackie.
The public speaker.
Yeah.
And her sidekick, Jane, the not public speaker.
Jenny Armstrong.
Jenny Barrow.
Jocelyn Milo.
Julie Stevenson.
Karina Jacobo.
Katie Radcliffe.
So fun to meet you in person, Katie. Kara Scara.
Chris Morgan.
Lara Bradbury.
Laura Keeley.
Lindsay Konopka.
Lori Farrington.
It's the funnest name to say, Konopka.
I was just going to say, like, I'm so jealous when you get to say Konopka.
Marjorie Lewis.
Mary McGowan.
Megan Montague.
Melissa Bowers.
Melissa Hancock.
Peter Rukavina.
Becky Zyba.
Sarah Kennedy.
Stacy Saywert.
Sunshine Haven.
Tammy Taravest.
Tara Wallace.
Val Packer.
Analog Wordle Wendy.
Thank you so much for all of our patrons, those who help keep the podcast going for the rest of the world.
We are so grateful for you. Thank you for helping us to keep the podcast going. If you would like to help the podcast go, but are not able to do a Patreon, please consider buying us tacos. We go actually eat tacos, and that's at buymeacoffee.com/widowwedonow.
And if none of those you want to do, then just give us a nice rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
That is free, freety free.
Yeah. All right, Mel. I think we're ready to get to our episode. It's a good one today, right?
As always, hello.
I know. Are we ever going to say, like, this is a mediocre one, guys? Sorry.
When I edited it, I had feelings.
Which is saying
it's
something,
saying
you guys.
Something. We think you'll really love this guest. She is an amazing human being with an incredible story, and she's one of us. So please enjoy.
I'm Anita.
I'm Mel.
We're two tired young widows, and we're just trying to figure out.
Widow.
Widow. Wait. Dude.
Now.
Mortal.
This episode is sponsored by the Meisner Family Foundation in memory of Elizabeth Meisner.
I'm so excited for our interview today, Mel. Are you excited?
Yes.
Okay. Can I tell you how this interview came to be?
Yes.
Okay. Once upon a time, I don't even remember where, when, why, how, but I went on a radio show. And I was talking to these people about death and about grief because I know everything about it. And then I don't know how, when, why, what, I found out that the host of that show's husband had ALS. And then I felt like a stupid idiot because I was like, oh, man. And so it's been a little while and I was like, I'm going to look her up. And I found out she was in the Widow Wives Club. What the heck?
Yeah, Widow Wives Club.
So this is our guest. And when I told Mel I wanted to interview her, she was like, wait, what's her husband's name? And I told her and she's like, oh, I know him. Scott knew him.
Yep.
And so it was like the circle was complete. And this is our guest. Her name is Lisa Valentine Clark. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. We're all connected now in this horrible club. And
we're here trying to help everyone out, right? And ourselves.
But I tell you, you guys make it cooler. So thanks.
You know, we just all do our part
right?
to make stupid things cooler.
It's on vogue to be a widow now.
Right. Everybody's doing.
So you have a radio show. What's it called?
It's called The Lisa Show, and it's a weekly podcast. And so, you know, like and subscribe, as the kids say.
Okay, everybody, do that.
It's just been like newly formatted. So I used to host a morning radio show, which is where we first met. And you did a great job. And you were about grief. You did an amazing job. And I remember thinking, I've got to remember this. And I'm not just saying this, like it was very helpful to me.
Oh, good.
So I have to thank you because grief is muddy and messy. And you were very graceful about the whole thing. So that's what it used to be. And now it's a weekly podcast that we just recently relaunched about a week ago. And you can download it on a BYU radio app or just like wherever you get your you know, podcasts. And I'm having a lot of fun having really deep dives into important topics that people care about.
If you need two crazy widows on your show,
always.
We know some. We're available.
Listen, it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Nobody has ever used the words graceful and me in the same sentence, so thank you.
Or me.
I'm taking that compliment. Lisa, where are you located?
I'm in Provo, Utah, and with my kids. My kids all live here for now, and, you know, some of them are getting ready to launch outwards and onward, and so who knows after that.
Spread their wings and fly.
Yeah, I guess that's what kids do. Rude.
How long have you been a host of said programs?
3 years. 3 years. So I did it was this early morning show, honestly, when my husband went on permanent disability and I needed to switch my gig from part-time freelance work to I needed to bring home the bacon. We had 5 kids, you know, at home and we needed health insurance and all that. So ever since then, and yeah, it's been 3 years now.
Okay, I have a serious question for you. When you do your radio show, or when you did your radio show, did you get super sweaty, or were you just like cool as a cucumber?
That is funny. I got really like, I'd get really nervous right before and like, let's go. But then when I was in there, it's like, I get in the zone.
She was in the flow, guys.
She's in show mode.
But I don't know if that's accurate because I'm just a super sweaty person, like regular, like baseline. So baseline sweaty. Yeah.
So Lisa, will you tell us about your husband? Tell us some things.
Okay. So I am married to Dr. Christopher Clark, and I'm going to say doctor because getting that PhD was no joke, and I paid for it with my blood, sweat, tears, and time. So Dr. Christopher Clark, and we met in college. We met at Brigham Young University. We were both English majors. He was fresh off his mission, and we were both auditioned for a Mysteries Creation production. You know, those really funny plays they do about the Bible.
What? I want to see this.
No, true story. He was cast as Satan and I was cast as a chicken on Noah's Ark.
What?
This is how we met. Yeah.
This is the best story ever.
I need like 5 minutes just to giggle about this for just a second. Satan and a chicken. Okay.
Tale as old as time. And we were friends for a long time first. We just kind of hung out. I just thought he was so funny. I mean, everybody just wanted to hang out with him. And I hung out with him and we were friends. And then about a year later, we started dating. And then about 9 months later, then we got married in 1995. So
in the 1900s.
Wow. That was so long ago. So last century. What was Chris a doctor of?
So he got his PhD in actually two different departments. He got his master's.
Satanology.
Yeah, exactly.
Satanic studies.
In satanic farm relations. Just kidding.
Oh, bad. That's bad.
No, this is where I'm here for this. I'm waking up now.
He eventually got his master's at Exeter University in staging Shakespeare, which is a terminal degree. But we were like, hey, we don't have any money. We have a lot of kids. We should just spend more money on getting you a doctorate that doesn't exist. So he kind of created his own in two different departments, in the theater department and in the education and leadership department. So it's a PhD of education leadership / theater.
Wow. Now I have to butt in for a second and say, like we mentioned earlier, my husband Scott was friends with Lisa's husband, Chris. And we were trying to figure out beforehand where they met. We're not quite sure. I think Scott might have acted in one of Chris's shows because if they were both directing, like they wouldn't cross paths, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I remember hearing about his ALS journey because the theater community in Utah, it's small and it's very tight and yep. It's very, everybody is connected and of course, theater people in general have big hearts and big yep. emotions, and they love to support each other. And when something happens that's terrible, I've never seen anything like it. Like when Scott died, I mean, you know how it is for people normally, like if someone in their life dies that's not like their person, they mourn for a little bit, but you know, a couple months, maybe they are kind of back to their life. The theater community grieved for 2 years, solid.
Yep. Yeah.
Solid, hardcore. So and I know there was a lot going around about Chris's illness and things to help support him. So it's just, it's interesting that we've both been, or that our people were a part of that community, but we've never met until now.
I know. It's so weird that we haven't met that community. I mean, you're going to get me to cry when I talk about how good that theater community is. When he got sick, it was like all hands on deck. What do you need? And even since then, you know, the way they check up on me, I mean, I can't say enough good things. You know, when he was diagnosed with ALS and they were like, what, you know, and everybody's like, what do you need? What can you do? And Chris's response was, I just want to laugh, you know, and his co-conspirator, Jenny Barlow, who's a choreographer and she's a theater director as well, was like, okay, what do you need me to do? And he's like, I just want to laugh. And they had done a show, Xanadu, at the Hale Center Theater in Orem. And if for people who haven't seen that, it's the most ridiculous show. It's on roller skates. It's super light. It's like the movie. And when we were dating, he was like, have you ever seen the movie Xanadu? And I was like, no, that sounds really cheesy. And he's like, you've got to see it. It's so funny. We watched it and like cried. We were laughing so hard. So this was part of our like dating story. So when he's like, I'm going to, you know, and he had directed it because he had seen it and, you know, in London and was like, it is so funny. And I want to bring it here to Utah. So he did. And he put it up. And then years later, when he was diagnosed with ALS and Jenny was like, what do you need from us? He's like, I just need to laugh. And she's like, well, let's just put on the most ridiculous show, Xanadu. And I mean, it has Pegasus and like, and, you know, roller skates. I mean, it's just glitter, everything. And it's so campy and so fun. And they put on a benefit show. Some of the actors from the original production that were on Broadway came back just to do this benefit concert. I mean, it was just this joyous night. We went every night. He, you know, in his frail state, dressed up every night, like sometimes it's like Zeus, sometimes it's like Sonny Malone with the short shorts and roller skates. Like, just to laugh and have a good time. And it's been such a great memory for like our kids to have. So joyous and amid all that pain.
Do you want to tell us how his diagnosis came about? And for those who don't know what ALS, do you want to tell us what ALS is?
Sure. ALS is the worst disease that you've ever heard of. And it is the cruelest. There's no known cause. There's no known treatment. And no, obviously no cure, and nothing new and exciting is really happening with it. There's always like, oh, I think there might be a drug that's in stage two. And we're always like, yeah, all right. Like, tell us when there's something that we can actually use. And so Christopher has been healthy his whole life, healthy lifestyle, you know, and nothing weird. And he just noticed a kind of a drag in his leg. Like my leg feels weird. And I was like, that's weird. You're fine. And then one day he came home and he's like, the weirdest thing happened to me. I was crossing the street, like to go get a sandwich or something. And a car was coming and I told my legs like, oh, we're going to run across. Like, you know, you're not even usually conscious of it. And it took a full second for them to actually move. And it's weird, Lisa. And I said, oh. And then, you know, when your knee, like you cross your knees and the doctor hits right under your kneecap just to check your reflexes, he said, look at this. He did it and it wouldn't stop shaking. And I was like, that's weird, but also not very worried because I have five kids and he's healthy and whatever. It got weird when he started like walking unusual. So we went to the doctor and we had assumed because he had had a bad back and he had had back surgery in his 20s, like most of his aunts and uncles, kind of a hereditary thing. Maybe you just need a tune up. You know, it's been a while since you had your back surgery, like 20 years. So let's just go get the MRI. So we started the process and it was clean. Everything was fine. And so then they said, well, maybe it's just up higher. Let's get another higher MRI. And when that was clean, everybody got a little nervous. And so they sent him to specialists and doctors. And so for about 3 months, which is actually a relatively short time, I'm finding out for other ALS like patients. I mean, it was kind of excruciating because they were testing for leukemia and blood disorders and brain tumors and like serious things. And on the bottom of that list of the things that they were checking for was the dreaded ALS. And I didn't realize, like, no one says it even as a theory out loud because it's such a worst case scenario. It's so rare that they don't say it until they're absolutely sure. So of course I went to, you know, WebMD like every other person. And my brother, who's a physician, was like, don't do that. Don't ever do that. And that was the first thing that came up. And I was like, well, it's not bad. I wonder what it is. Yeah, I mean, that's how we were just out of it. But after a lot of MRIs and a brain scan and like just fear and panic and blood tests, a lot of blood tests and everything, he finally was sent to a physician who wouldn't even say it out loud, just wrote on a prescription pad, like diagnosis ALS, and sent him to a specialist. And so he went to the parking lot by himself with this paper that says, what? And he looked it up on his phone and he was like, what? It was awful. Made the appointment with the specialist who confirmed, you know, our worst fears and things. So it took so he was officially diagnosed in March, March 26th of 2016. After we had like come to terms with that, we didn't really like say anything. We were really in shock. And finally, like 2 weeks later, told our kids and our family, and it was awful. And telling people I underestimated how difficult that would be.
Remember when the ice bucket challenge thing was going around? Was this before or after that? Because there has not been a lot of attention on ALS until that, I would say, in social media.
After. Christopher would always make the joke, well, I didn't do the ice bucket challenge, so I got ALS. It's like chain letters. If you don't do it, you're going to get it. So it's my own. So he's like, it's my own fault. Yeah. I remember thinking, why are people doing this? Are they really donating money or whatever? But yeah, we felt real dumb about that.
Wow. I would, I mean, when you're talking about the foot drop and the drag and that stuff, it's like, oh man, could that be MS? Like what? Man.
Well, and I'll tell you, for a couple of weeks, we were really hoping it was MS. Like that was the best case scenario. Cause I was like, people can live with MS for a really long time. That would be great if it was.
At a certain stage. Yeah.
And at then- a certain stage, you think, oh, I'd much rather have that. Well, and I remember for a couple of weeks, I was hoping it was a brain tumor because at least you could operate. Like it does such crazy things. Like, I'm like, why am I praying that this is a brain? Oh, because this is the best case scenario right now. Because anyway, it, you know, getting a terminal disease where they go, basically they say, I'm so sorry. Whatever we can do to make you comfortable.
I can't believe the guy just wrote it on a pad and didn't say it. Is that, are they just scared of it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And also I think too, they want... they don't want to be the one that says it, and they're not a specialist. And in fact, I will say, so my brother and his wife, my sister-in-law, are both physicians. And as we were going through this arduous process, and I was just crying to them, like, what do you think? My brother very calmly was saying things like, he is getting the best standard of care. I would first do this, get this, and then we'll reevaluate. Like he's like, you have to be very cautious. But he and his wife already knew that he had ALS 2 weeks before we did. They had talked about it, like, it can't be anything. Like, but you can't say that unless you are absolutely sure. So they were waiting, like the other, I think, doctors, just to, it was a horrible place to live in. And as horrible as it was, there was some sense of relief of like, okay, we're not crazy. At least we know what we're dealing with now when he got diagnosed, which is such a weird mind game, and introduced me to complicated grief.
Oh, did your kids know what ALS was?
No. Mm-mm.
Did you before you Googled it?
Not before I Googled it. No. And so what was really hard is that we had 5 kids ages 8 to 18. So when we sat them down and said, this is really serious, and this is what this disease is, and this is what it does, and your dad is going to die from this disease. This is how, like, it was so weird to think, I know how my husband dies. Like, there's no mystery to it. Like, this is, it will kill him. It kills 100% of nobody, like, then dies of something else. Like, this is what will kill him. And it was hard to explain that. My 18-year-old at the time was the only one that understood. And by all of their reactions, he sort of left to deal with his own emotions. The rest of them were just concerned with playing video games, and because we interrupted them doing something else. And I mean, now obviously it's, you know, 6 and a half years. And we've since talked about that because the 4 younger ones just said, I had no idea what you're talking about. Like, I remember thinking, oh, mom's really sad. So I had to re-explain it to them, and they had to watch it and relearn it because of their development, which again was torture.
We've interviewed people and they've had lots of different diagnoses, a lot of different cancers. And, you know, we talk about glioblastoma and how, or pancreatic cancer, and how it's almost a death warrant.
Yeah.
But it's not an absolute death warrant, but ALS is, you're going to die. We just don't know exactly how long it's going to take, and it's going to steal everything from you before you die.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to move. You're going to lose the ability to talk. You're going to lose the ability to feed yourself, to move, and your loved ones are going to get to take care of you through this whole process. I mean, I can't think of any really more evil disease.
No, it's so cruel. My husband was claustrophobic too. So the idea of slowly like being trapped inside of your body was also psychologically tricky. And knowing that there's nothing you can do about it. And also he's very high energy. And like, I call it like ants in your pants disease, like where he can't sit still. And he would always have like a rubber band or a piece of plastic or a receipt or something or a twisty tie. People, you know, his actors used to make fun of him because they're always like, what are you chewing on and what are you fiddling with? Because that's how he would focus, right? Like he was always playing with something or doing something. So just to slowly stop and become trapped in your own body was very, very difficult. And he handled it so well, I can't even say.
I have a question, and Anita and I ask guests and each other all the time, and at random points we'll like revisit this question. And most people say that they would not change the circumstance of how their person died, because probably just because it's what they know, or they're like, well, I got time with him, or for a sudden death, we're like, well, we're glad they didn't suffer. I want to ask you, as somebody who lost their person to ALS, would you have rather had him die a sudden death than have him go through ALS and you guys go through ALS with him?
That's so hard for me to, because I remember doing the same thing in my mind, like, well, at least we have him here and it's worth it at any cost, right? So if I, but I hate that he had to suffer. And I hate that it was so cruel. But the way that he then, that was his fear at the initial diagnosis, but then the way that he actually lived his life, which was making jokes, showing up, still being a really like good husband, a great father, still teaching until he lost his voice. When he lost his voice, still directing with an assistant, still writing plays, still making us laugh, still taking his kids to concerts and movies and interacting and being there. I mean, he adapted and adapted. So he was still him and he was still alive and he didn't lay in bed and feel sorry for himself, although nobody would have, you know, faulted him for it. And he certainly had his moments, but they didn't even happen every day where he felt bad or he would break down or cry. He insisted, and he did get up every morning and we would shower him. Like, who with all their capabilities and capacities showers every day and washes their hair, you know, and brushes their teeth, like, but he insisted on that and keeping that routine every day until the day before he died, he did that. So the way he lived his life, like he lived it to the fullest. And it wasn't, I think, what we feared in the beginning. You know, I mean, by the end, to be quite honest, he could only move a little bit of his neck and one thumb to be able to communicate with the screen. You know, he had a feeding tube, like he couldn't do anything else. He drooled a lot. We were trying to get that, you know, under control, but we still like laughed a ton every day. He still interacted. We still had conversations. He was still present. And so I don't want to dishonor that by saying, ugh. But there is this part of me that I made an agreement with him. He wasn't afraid to die too. He had like come to a good place where he was not afraid of death. And he would talk about what he hoped he'd be able to do on the other side, you know, and continue to parent, continue to influence. And that was really, really difficult for me. But he said to me all the time, I'm not afraid to die. I'm not afraid to die. I've come to peace with it. Like, there's nothing I can do. But he was afraid of suffering. And that was something then that I could kick in and say, I promise you, I will not let you suffer. And I kept my promise. And right when it got to the tipping point, and we had the hardest conversation of my whole life. And I just remembered that promise. And I just said, I won't let you suffer. So, you know, which for ALS is when your oxygen levels, when you can't breathe and you're suffocating because the muscles that, you know, are like all of your muscles in ALS, the synapses don't receive the signal. So they atrophy and die. So once he started having a really hard time taking a deep breath, and we knew that, I made him comfortable and I kept my promise that he wouldn't have to suffer. And, you know, which was, I think that is like where I know how to answer that question, because in that moment I was like, I'm not done. I can still get you up, get you dressed. And like, we're in and lift up a grown man. And at that time I was the only one doing it because it was the pandemic and we couldn't have our aides come in. And I was like, I can still do this. Like, put me in, coach. Like, I wasn't done. I wasn't to the max of like, I can't do this anymore. I was like, no, I'm in it. I am focused. It's worth it. You're funny. You're here. You're my husband. I love you. You're helping raise the kid. Like, let's do it. But when it got to, how much do I have to suffer? How much longer do I have to suffer? And that word, then I was like, no, I'm not going to ask that of you. That's just for what I want.
So how long did it take him from diagnosis until he died?
4.5 years.
How does that compare to other ALS
people with ALS.
The average life expectancy is 2 to 5 years. And that's what we would tell people when he was diagnosed. When he's diagnosed, we said the average life expectancy is 2 to 5 years. And I've known people, like we've had friends, we were in a support group who go very quickly, you know, like under a year. We had a friend that went at 18 months and then we had a friend that went at 5 years. So you just, you know, about then, but I remember thinking he'll be the one because that Chris Clark is always so lucky. What a charmed life. He'll be the one that, and I kept thinking, if we can get 10 years, then our youngest will be 18. Just 10 years. And I had, you know, to give that dream up.
No, because he didn't do the ice bucket challenge. No. Had he done the ice bucket challenge, 10 years easy.
And he never did a chain letter, so.
Oh, question. So we talked a little about the theater community before this. And I want to ask you, just because I remember seeing it circle back, these benefits to help Chris. There were more than one, right? Like, I remember there being a couple or multiple events.
Oh, yeah.
And I just want to add, my musician community heard of it and was part of it. It is not normal, everyone, that the theater and the musician community get together. And so the fact that I heard about it from my musician friends is, like, wild. Like, that's how much of an influence Chris had in various circles. So will you talk to us a little bit about what you experienced from those communities, from people that wanted to help you? How was that for your family, for Chris?
Christopher just gathers people wherever he goes, right? He is a light. And everyone is drawn to him. They just want to be around him. He's so fun. It was like that when I met him. Everybody just wanted to know what he was saying and doing. He just has that he's charming. Everyone wants to be around Chris Clark. And so like I kind of said in the beginning, it was so overwhelming because we lived in a 70s ramp, like four different like half levels, like this old 1970s house. And our doctors were like, you need to like have a chairlift, or one doctor was like, you better get a cherry picker to get from one level. And I was like, a cherry picker? What are you talking about? You could go in through the window. And I was like, this is bananas. And my dad, who's a realtor, was like, well, maybe you should just get a one level rambler. Like, what are you going to do? Well, and we decided, because our support group was so great in our neighborhood, and we didn't want to uproot our kids who were already going through trauma to like change schools and neighborhoods and everything, to make our house handicapped accessible. And then we needed to think about getting a handicapped accessible van, you know, so that our family could, you know, so he could be mobile, and all these things are really, really expensive. And my family really, really rallied. I have a brother who's very generous, and he was like, you know, whatever you need to make Chris comfortable, because none of this stuff is covered by insurance, by the way. And a lot of reports for ALS will say that it costs about $250,000 a year to live with ALS, just in home renovations and, you know, like a shower chair that you think, okay, yeah, how am I going to get this grown man into a shower that I can wheel in and out? It's like $4,000. I mean, it's ridiculous. The costs add up. And so Jenny Barlow and her husband Blake were like, okay, we're going to put on this show, this Xanadu, to help offset some of these costs. So that's what they did right at the beginning. And we felt so great. And it helped us get that like handicapped accessible van. It just like helped contribute to this, like, how are we going to like all these huge changes? And then I had, you know, generous help from my family, and then people, you know, like in my church community and in my neighborhood, like rallied to sort of help. And we had a friend who helped, you know, donate the architecture to know the addition on the house, so he could just live in his house just comfortably. And I just can't say enough nice things about people. It was so overwhelming to us about the love of the people that like came in, and that theater community, of course, like you're talking about, and music community, who were like, yeah, we'll do it, whatever you want. Like, and then like I have, you know, an improv troupe, and then we were like, when we'll do shows. I mean, everybody was just like, let's just pitch in and put on a show to help old Professor Clark. And it just felt so like so exciting and loving. Like, you want to do something when somebody's sick, right? And you just don't know what to do. And he's just like, I just want to be together and laugh and create art. And, you know, and that's kind of the cheesy message in Xanadu too. At the end, it was like, to create art is love, you know, like together. And that's what we were able to do. So when he kept progressing And after we had done that, and the house is done, and it's getting worse, and it's getting bleaker, and it's getting darker. And it's been 3 years since we put on Xanadu. And now it's the reality of what it is. Now he can't speak. Now he's in a full wheelchair, the big one that weighs, you know, thousands of pounds and is hard to get around. And now he gets really tired a lot and can't go out a lot and can't speak, you know, all of these things. It's like, it's different when it's just like, yeah, I got this disease. Let's see what happens. And then it happens. And Christopher felt so like, what do people with ALS do when they don't have the resources in the community that we have? And I'm like, oh, they die. I mean, because we saw people who were like, you get so depressed and you stay in your bed all day long that you die. He was able to live longer and enjoy life longer and give that to our kids because we had so many people who were like, yeah, we can do this. But people who don't have that kind of community and can't afford it, like I remember hearing about somebody who just had to sit in a lazy boy chair. The wife had to go to work, would come home on her lunch break and check on him and kind of spoon feed him and then go back to work and then come home and take, and he just had to sit there, not attended to his needs, just not moving. And it just broke our hearts. So Christopher had this sense of like, well, let's do a benefit concert, but let's donate the money to this Rocky Mountain ALS Foundation that buys equipment and then loans it out to lots of people, that provides home repair for other people who don't have that. And so everybody got on board. So those other kind of benefits that we had were for that organization and to kind of like spread the love and to raise money.
You kind of addressed this a little bit, but I remember there have been certain points where people have done really generous and kind things and they do it and then it gets done. And then I feel almost bad because it didn't fix it. And so I still have this kind of like bad feeling in my heart, this sadness. And then I'm like, what was that even for? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And like, I want to be like, thank you, you guys, you know, you did this and it fixed everything. And I'm like, you did this. And I still feel like crap. And so I don't know how to react or respond or talk about it because it didn't fix any of it.
That's a really interesting point. That's so fascinating to me because we kind of felt that like we would joke, like here, Chris is like, can't move, right? We would pick him up, just this frail, he'd lost weight. He had a feeding tube. Like he was just frail. And we'd put him in the front row at the Hale Center Theater, you know, for the second benefit concert that we're having for other people that have ALS, and put on this ridiculous show and laugh and laugh and laugh. And Christopher would type out, when he'd get back in his wheelchair in the screen, like, yay, we did it. We cured ALS, because of course we didn't, you know, and we were acknowledging it like, yay, we did it. Oh, you're still sick and dying. Okay. But because it was funny, like, and that dark sense of humor came out, but I'll tell you, it did make us look around, and Christopher would say this, and I will say this till the day I die, is that we weren't alone in our tragedy. We were going through hell. And our friends met us and said, this is horrible. Let's put on a show. Let's make fun of this. This is ridiculous. We hate this. And Christopher would go every night and look everybody in the face and say, I love you. I love you. I love you. I don't want anyone to ever wonder how I feel about them. And it might be the last time I see him. I mean, it really could. So he would just be like, thank you for coming. I love you. Thank you for doing this. It made me laugh. It made this dying man's dream come true. And my kids still talk about it. So you like, and I told him too, because he felt so guilty. Like, we are so blessed. And we had the wheelchair and the handicap van, and it made my life so much better. I think I live longer. I feel guilty that other people don't have that. And I said to him, don't worry, I will spend the rest of my life fundraising for ALS. And that will be my thing. Like, I will try to give back to that community. You just live. And it's changed my kids and how they see and show up for people who are in impossible situations. And they know it's important to show up and it's important to say something instead of saying nothing. And they know how to grieve with other people. And sending five children, most of whom are adults now, out into the world who know how to grieve and help people, Christopher and I feel pretty good about that.
That's amazing. I love that you said this sucks. Let's put on a show. Isn't that classic theater people? You guys, if you don't have theater people in your life, you really need to get some, because that is true. And
if you get a terminal disease, get yourself some theater friends. By golly.
Seriously. Ah.
I feel like theater friends are like life insurance, though. You need them before you get the diagnosis, because afterwards it might be too late.
Except I do have to say, because it's weird, because I'm in the theater community, but in not so much in the local community one, but in more of like the touring, the Broadway touring, because I played for touring shows.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know a lot of the people in the community here. And so I would get to know them through Scott a little bit. And we weren't married, you know, very long, almost 2 years. But I cannot even express how amazing those people were that adopted me as if I were part of Scott. I mean, I guess I was, whatever. Yeah. But it's like they were still there after. And sometimes they were the only ones that still stuck with me, other than a couple friends. So have you noticed that they're still reaching out to you and still there for you?
Yeah, they still say, hey, do you want tickets to this show? Hey, come see my show. Or that one of his former students, Eric Phillips, who took his classes and then had, like, when he first started teaching and then like was a theater advisor for one of his sketch comedy show that he had done. They just became friends after he graduated because they were close in age, and he's been to our house, and like, we just have all just been friends, and he's gone on to do some amazing things. And now he's this great, like, you know, writer for all these, like, you know, for all these TV shows that have won Emmys. And like, I mean, he's just become really successful, and he's gone through a lot of the, you know, the Chris's, like hit all of hit the different theater styles and teaches. He's just in that position that he went to all of them. He knows all of the things that Chris taught. So right now he's compiling it all, like just the Chris Clark craft, if you will, and putting it all together. He still checks in on me. We have lunch together. I mean, he's trying to contribute to that Chris Clark legacy of like, this man changed my life, put me on a course, and we need to take, you know, what he taught and how he taught and put it together so other people can benefit from it. So it's just ridiculous.
So I have a question about knowing that your person is going to die. You said that you talked about some really hard conversations about how he didn't want to suffer. What other hard conversations did you have? And how did you prepare for the what was coming? Because you knew it was coming. We talked to a lot of people who have a potentially terminal illness and they don't talk about those things because they almost feel like it's inviting that in. But this was not an invitation. This was like coming whether or not you invited it in. So how did you guys prepare, or did you, or what?
Well, I think in the beginning, you know, we went through different phases. Like the first year, I don't think that I really fully, I thought we're going to figure something out. There will be a cure. And if there's just a treatment that can buy us enough time until a cure, then we'll be good. And this is manageable. And I look back at that, Lisa, and think, oh, you poor, poor dummy. But it was, but I think it was part of shock and grief. And I also think that my subconscious wanted to have hope, and it served me well. So there's that. Then as it went on, and as I remember about a year into his diagnosis, waking up one morning and kind of thinking about things and thinking, he is going to die of this disease. There's no outsmarting or outworking it. Because I am like, well, I'll make a chart and then this will make him comfortable and I'll anticipate his every need. And I still have my binder of all of my notes of all of the different things we could try and do and regiment to, because, and I keep it as like a reminder of, you tried really, really hard. Like, you tried so hard. You didn't just give up. Like, you tried everything. And also just to remind myself of that, right? But as more time went on and we sort, I don't want to say like lost hope, but lost hope of no one is getting out of ALS alive. We kind of thought, oh, it took this long for his legs to lose, so it'll take that long for his arms, but his arms went really fast. you know, oh, it'll take. And then his voice went even faster. So we were like, oh, we're not in control of any of this. We are absolutely out of control of all of this. And so as we got more comfortable with that and just making him comfortable, and then he would, like, at first he didn't want to get into a wheelchair because he didn't want to look sick, but like, when he was walking with a walker, he would trip and his chances of falling, but he was so resistant to it. And once he accepted, no, this is helping me just like enjoy talking to my friends and family a little more, then he accepted it. It wasn't giving up. Does that make sense? So that's how we were able to talk about these things. The other great thing about Chris Clark is he really wanted to stay present in the moment and have a lot of ordinary days where we were just complaining about our kids and yelling at them about their curfew and homework. Like, he wanted those regular days where we weren't like, oh dear father, you know, what would, you know, let's have a special moment in memory, right? Like, he didn't want to live like, you know, in all the preciousness of it, because it felt like, he's like, I don't want to say goodbye every day for the rest of my life. I want to live my life. So we went on vacations and made memories and did that as long as we could. And then when things shut down and it's COVID and we're not going anywhere, and we know, I was like, he gets a cold and he's dead. So he gets COVID, it's over. And we kind of shut down. And at that time, anyway, his disease had progressed so much to the point that we were having, you know, big conversations. So some of the other hard conversations we had was, what will life look like for me when he dies? He kept saying, oh, this is gonna make me cry. He's like, I'm fine. I'm at peace. And he was, he's like, I know I'm going to die and that this is what God wants for me. And I'm at peace with it. Like, I think I've tried to live a good life. I've done the best that I can. I haven't been perfect, but like, I've lived a good life and I'm proud of it. And I don't want to go, but the writing is on the wall and I am at peace with it. And I know that, you know, our religious belief, he was like, I know that my spirit will still exist. And he was so confident, and it would make me so mad. Even though I share the same belief, but it would make me mad how confident he was. He's like, I know I'll be able to help and influence you on the other side, and that I'll be there helping our kids and guiding. And I'm like, you don't know, you could get over there and be assigned to something else. And he's like, that makes no sense to me.
And, potato and, farming.
Yeah. I mean,
he's
I don't
been
know.
Assigned to the gulag.
The planet Saturn.
Yeah. We've never been over there. We don't know.
Right.
Anyway. And so we had those conversations about what he thought life would be like for him, but more of like what he wanted for me. And, you know, and to hear him say, he was like, Of course I know that you love me and that you're sad, but I don't want you to like give into that grief and have it ruin your life. And he's like, I want you to live your life and not feel bad about it. And I want you to go and keep creating and keep, and be happy for our kids and be really happy and not just faking it. And I want you to get remarried. I think this life is too hard to go it alone. And I want you to find somebody else. And I want you, and he would say these things so boldly, and I would just cry. And I'd be like, well, that's so great that you want that. But what about me? What do I want? He'd be like, Lisa, no, really. And I'd say, you know, like, just don't die. And then we don't have to talk about this. Like, that was such a weird thing for me. Like, cause it made me physically sick just to think, because I was so in, how can I make this lovely man's life better? How can I, like, cause I think, okay, so now he's having trouble swallowing. So I'm going to get another suction so that I can suction out the saliva that he can't swallow. So I was always thinking of the next step to make his life more comfortable. Okay. So when he can't do that, then I'm going to make sure that I order this, cause this will help him be more comfortable. I'll get this pillow. I'll get this adjustable bed. I was always thinking about the next thing. And so when I was asked to think about life without him, it went blank. It was like, at the end there, I was constantly like cleaning up his drool or readjusting him in his chair because he'd slump down, or giving him water or adjusting his feeding tube or cleaning or stretching or helping and adjust with his community constantly. So when he passed, I was like, what do people do? What do I do with my hands? Because I had lost all that purpose and focus. So he was trying to have those hard, important conversations with me. And I was so overwhelmed with the task and the life at hand that it was so hard for me to see past that. It was like, it was like my life stopped when he died. In the future, like, I was like, I can't even, like, I don't know, it'll be awful and we'll do stuff and who cares? You know, it was like that. I don't care. Yeah. What do I do with all this stuff?
You can't buy a pillow to fix your grief. You can't buy another suction device. You can't do any of those things. But I have a suggestion for what to do with your hands now. I heard that Chris would have a twisty tie or a piece of paper.
I play with things now.
You just get a twisty tie. It'll fix everything.
Yeah. Do you have fidget spinners and bubble pops?
Yep. All the things. I'm like, now what do? I just flitter around.
So Lisa, so he's died since then, obviously.
Yeah.
How long has it been as of today, as of this recording?
21 months.
Okay. So you guys have had those conversations. He's gone. What has your life looked like since then?
It looks totally different. I feel totally different. I've had some hard times, and I'm still here, and I'm so proud of myself. You know, and I know that he's proud of me too, because on my worst days, like, I'll allow myself, you know, every once in a while just to stay in bed and like cry and just like feel bad for myself. But I can count on one hand how many days I've actually done that. It doesn't help me. It doesn't make me feel better. I'm sort of the grief of get up and do, you know, like stay busy, do stuff. And I know it sounds so cheesy, but I really do feel like he's cheering me on. Like, yes, this is what, go, you, yes. And there's just been a couple of moments where something will happen and I'll think, Chris would love this. And it fills me with that kind of light that was like when he was here, that I wish I had those experiences more often. But so life is still, I still have to think about living, which I never had to do before he died. I never had to think about, like, I am going to get up and put my clothes on. Now I'm going to go to work. And today I'm going to accomplish two things. I'm going to make dinner and I'm going to sweep the floor. Like, I talk to myself like a toddler. And now 21 months later, you know, it's less obvious, you know, it's becoming a little bit more automatic, but it's, you know, that grief, I explain it like, it's just a 2x4 to the face. You're just walking along and you're like, I think I'm feeling better. You know, it's so great. And then out of nowhere, 2x4 just smacks you in the face and knocks you off. And you're like, wait, how could I avoid that? Why didn't I duck? Yes. And why does this feel like he just died? Like, you know, and you're like, I thought I had all those triggers taken care of, but I'm learning now just to sort of like, let it come. So you cry. And then in 5 minutes you can be done and then do something else. It doesn't have to ruin your whole day.
So you are a caretaker, and that's an exhausting job in and of itself.
Praises to you.
Yes. I'm curious, how has your health been? Because a lot of caretakers, like, they've depleted their bodily, this sounds gross, bodily resources and their energy, and there is an element maybe of relief, but the person is gone. And so it's like complicated. How is your health?
Oh, that's so nice of you to ask. That is going to make me cry. You know, when I was taking care of Chris, I had to physically lift a grown man, like a lot during the day. And it was hard, and my back and hurt in my shoulders. And so I started really working out a ton and like running for my mental health, which kind of saved me. I would just like, I got to run away from home. I've got a half an hour and the kids can just, and I'm going to run, like literally running away from home with the music so loud in my ears. And that was my mental. Especially like during COVID and things like that, like I started lifting a lot of weights and stuff. And I gained about 20 pounds, but of muscle. I was so proud of myself. Like I gained weight, like I looked like sturdy. And I was like, how do I say to Chris, look at me. I can
I can bench press you.
I can lift you up. And he'd be like, this is so hot. Like, this is so amazing. Like, and so it was kind of funny. And then after he died, I lost like 30 pounds. I didn't want to eat. I would forget to eat, which if I love food, it was so, and it was the caregiving thing. I just felt, I was like wander around. Like, I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. Like, I remember saying to my sister, so people just go to work and then come home and eat dinner and go to bed. Like they just do one thing, because I had been out of the, like, okay, now you do this. And now, you know, like I would wake up at 4 a.m, go to work, come home at 10 and then take care of Chris, get him up and get him ready and stuff, finish some work, take care of the kids, connect with them, go to bed at 10 and then do the whole thing over again and sleep from 10 to 4 while my son took care of him. And so it just was so frantic. So my health really took a hit because my body was like, we don't know what we're doing right now. And it was almost like I had to remember how to eat and exercise and sleep. Cause I felt guilty for sleeping and I was absolutely exhausted, but didn't think I was. And then, and so I got my anxiety and depression under control. I have a really good doctor that was like, let's do this first. Let's do this next. And I had a really great sister who would be like, why don't we just go on a hike? And why don't you eat this today? And it was like little baby steps and it was good. So now I feel like
it's kind of manageable, under control. I have sorry, I have so many questions.
I love it.
I'm going to give you some context for this. I have been okay. Well, first of all, this has to do with the 5 stages of grief. And Anita, and I hate the 5-stage model.
I hate them.
Thank you. This is my question about it, because I've been listening to a book about borderline personality disorders, and it's called Stop Walking on Eggshells. So it's for people who have borderline or family members.
Okay.
And I'm trying to learn more about it because it's hard.
That's smart.
It's kind of the worst. But they've mentioned the 5 stages of grief in there. And every time Anita and I both have this like, this like antenna pops up. Anytime we hear 5 stages, we're like, ding, ah, no. And so my little spidey sense went off and I was like, no, no, no. What are you going to say? What are you going to say? Just let's get rid of this thing. And this is where it made sense to me. It said, as a family member of somebody that has this disorder, you will experience the 5 stages of grief. And that's when it made sense to me. Because, you know, the 5 stages are for somebody who's dying. So I have 2 questions for you. Number one, did Chris experience anything remotely like the 5 stages since he was diagnosed with something terminal and he was going to be dying? Number two, as a family member of somebody with a disease, did you experience any of that? Like that would kind of jive with the 5 stages?
I think for Chris, you know, at first it was like, let's see if I can outwork this or outthink it. And then and total denial of, well, I'm just going to work and not think about it. And then it got quickly, because I think of the dramatic nature of it, quick to, he was faster, I think, to acceptance than most people. But the more I've read about the 5 stages of grief, I realize it's for someone who is dying. And I didn't find it helpful for me. What I did find helpful was after he passed, I found a book called Anxiety, The Forgotten Stage of Grief. And it was recommended to me by a dear friend. And I read, and by the way, after he died, I read every book on the afterlife and every book on grieving. So at like stacks and stacks, I would order them. And I remember my sister coming over to my house and looking, she goes, hey, what's this? What are you doing? Oh, you're going to research grief. You're going to find a shortcut, are you? And I was like, yeah. Yeah. And she's like, okay. Good luck. Anyway, this was the best book for me because I read it and I go, me, 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 me. And I was like, oh, this is manifesting it in anxiety. I feel all of this. And this, and obviously being a caregiver for so long, you know, and mourning the loss of, you know, my favorite person, the combination, it was so, so helpful. And so that stage of grief, whenever I think of grief, I think my grief was anxiety and this is how it manifested it. And so I treat it differently than I would have treated, you know, a different stage of grief, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I wish it wasn't even called stages.
I know.
Because that makes it seem like, oh, you go from this stage to this stage, or even like in theater lingo, you go from theater in the round to the next show over to this, the main stage.
As if you like level up.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, if you just push yourself through, that's so great. It's like, oh, please get me to the other end. Get me to the other end. And we all have to come to this place, this awful, horrible realization. And for me, it had to be several times for me to understand the lesson. You have to learn how to live with this forever. You have got to learn how to, you're never going to put it down. So just learn how to carry it better. Just, and make friends with it. And that calmed my anxiety. That made it last not as long and not be so disruptive.
So I just feel like when you were talking about the hard, I'm sorry, I'm going back for a minute, but just I had this visual and I want to explain it to you because I think it's awesome because I'm awesome. That's
yes,
not what
are.
I meant. But
yes, no, you are.
But just when Chris was talking to you about what he wanted for you after he was gone, I just feel like I had this visual of him wrapping up a gift for you. And the gift was to release you from a lot of the guilt and expectations that people put on widows. And then he set it there for you. And I mean, at first you're like, screw you, I don't want your gift, right? But I hope that at some point for you, you'll be able to unwrap that gift and you'll be able to take that and say thank you. And it might not be all at once. It might be piecemeal. You know, it might be he said he wanted this for me and I accept that gift now and I'm going to do that. And then at some point in time, you'll be able to accept all of those gifts that he gave you in that regard.
That's a very generous thing to say. And if you knew Chris, you would know that. I mean, he really means what he says, and he is so generous. And I think when you love people like he did, he just loved them exactly how they were. And he certainly did with me, and no one's known me as well. He knew what I was going to struggle with. And he said things that I wasn't even conscious of that he knew I would worry about. And just said them so that it would be done. And it was a really, really generous act. And, you know, it's quite something when someone loves you like that, despite what that means to them. Because it was hard for him to think about a life with his not being here.
Yeah. And when people try and give you his gift, like, for him to you does not go over well. They're like, well, he would want you to be happy and he would want you to date again. You're like, it's my gift to open. Leave me alone.
And how dare you speak on his behalf?
Yes.
You know,
don't talk about Christopher, Dr. Christopher on his behalf.
No, but you know, and he had conversations with like close family members and my children about what he wanted for me to reassure me that I'm just finding out about that.
Oh, he was too good.
He was too good.
I don't care if he didn't do the ice bucket challenge.
Yeah, he didn't need to.
All is forgiven. Ugh.
Even before I met you, Lisa, I have had such respect for Chris just because of what I've heard through other people about him. And I know that you believe in an afterlife. I mean, I do too. I have experiences all the time. And I have a close friend who has actually died and come back. Near-death experience. You know, I was like you, like when Chris died, it's like, I have to research the afterlife. I need to know everything. Give me this ones about science and energy and quantum physics and quantum entanglement. And I want to know this one. And I've read them all. And I'm just like, okay, more science. Tell me, like, let me figure out these properties. Because energy has to go somewhere, right? Whatever.
Yes.
That's the whole other thing. But my friend told me that he did not think there was an afterlife. He thought there was eternal blackness. And he basically woke up dead. There was not blackness. I mean, a lot of the stuff he couldn't explain in words because a lot of it is felt because there's not language. It's like energy transfer. But he was telling me what he saw because he has a sister who is widowed. And he goes, I saw how it works over there. And I saw everybody has their own networks. And he goes, and when people are in this life in networks, their people above are in networks too. And I just imagine right now, Chris and Scott and Jason are hanging out right now. Like, I don't know if it's because I've had a griefy day, but like I totally feel like they are like I feel that all the time from the other side where it's like, I'm like, I know Scott's there cheering me on. I know like my dad just died and now my dad, you know? And so I don't know. I just have this visual of them being together and they're just so happy and they're over there doing their thing and we're here and we're so sad, but we're all doing it.
I just need you to know that Jason's favorite musical was Xanadu.
You guys!
Ding, ding, ding! Ding,
you know what's happening. Right now, Chris and Scott are like, oh, we have already been doing Xanadu up here, and Jason is the star.
And Chris is like, and it's bigger than anything. Because we have unlimited resources. And Melanie, Christopher used to say that all the time. He said, who do we hang out with and who are we? Because he used to always joke with his brothers and sisters of like, great, I'm going to be hanging out in heaven with, you know, like our great aunt or grandma, like nobody our age, you know, and they would tease him about that. Like, yeah, well, like go have fun. And he would tell me the people we associate with here on earth, not just our families, but like our friends, our neighbors, the people we do theater with. He's like, that's who you hang out with on the other side. Why would it be different? Why would we have anything different than that? And he felt that so strongly. So when you're talking this whole time, I'm like, Chris Clark would love what you're saying. Christopher was so into that in life. Like he always like loved like mediums and loved to talk about spirituality. And he's like, it totally goes in line with my spiritual beliefs. And cause it's organized and it makes sense. And he was always into that. And I was always like, yeah, 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 whatever. And I know he's laughing at me now. Cause now I'm like reading all of his books and going, yeah, wait, tell me more. Now I want to really know.
Yeah.
And I do feel like, you know, his sister, Chris's sister, Stephanie was in a plane crash, you know, and burned over 80% of her body and wrote a book about it and had was in a coma and had a death experience and got to, you know, they used to talk about it all the time, especially as he got sick. And it was really comforting to him because he knew that she also felt like, you will be bathed in love. You will not be suffering. You will be happy. And that actually really carried me through those first really like couple of months right after he died. Cause here I am hyper vigilant about his constant care, like day and night. Like, is he okay? Is he still breathing? Is he okay? Da, 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 to nothing. And I'd be like, is he okay? I just need to see. You can't just take care of somebody like that fully for that long and then be like, oh good, well, but you know, like my body, everything felt wrong. Like I'm supposed to, is he okay? Is he okay? Is he okay? And I felt that. I felt this like, please be happy for me. This energy of like, I am free. I am not in pain. Like, please be happy for me. Please be happy for me. And that really was carried me through those early, early days of grief.
You know, it's so funny. I think this is because Scott had a sudden death, but because of all the near-death stuff I hadn't read before and known, I'm like, I know he's fine and he's not suffering. And I'm down here on my floor in my closet screaming my guts yes! out. You suck, Scott, because I know it's fine there. You're the worst.
Me, I'm like, I promised you that you wouldn't suffer. You didn't. What about me?
Right?
I'm suffering without you. And you know, we all got to figure it out. Because, you know, he didn't choose that. Like, that's the thing. Like we can, in our grief, you can change your whole personality. Right. And this is why I think I'm so drawn to talk to other, you know, widows and widowers, like about their experience. Cause I'm like, how do you push back through that? Like, how do you not become yes, you change and you become a different person. We all know that, but like, how do you not become bitter or somebody that you don't recognize or somebody you don't want to, when this is so horrible? And so I love it when people talk about it, like, and you can acknowledge it. And like, I've had that feeling and I've said that and I'm still standing or I'm still going or, you know, how do you do that?
Lisa, thank you. This has been awesome.
Thank you. This has been wonderful for me and very validating. So thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. You are awesome and hilarious and super talented. And thank you for not making us feel stupid because you're like a professional and we just do this, you know, in our basements. So
you guys are so professional, the most, and graceful. I stand by it.
Twice in my life now. We hope everybody else has enjoyed this episode. Lisa, where can they find you in all of the atmospheres?
find me talking about life over at The Lisa Show on BYU Radio, or you can go to thelisashowpodcast.com and it'll have a link of all the places that you can listen to it. So I hope you'll listen and subscribe. And you know, sometimes I do, because it's my life, I do talk about some of the issues that we've talked about today too.
Excellent.
There's one last question we need to ask Lisa, and I will do the honors because I have the tiny hands. What is your favorite cheese?
Oh, it's like my favorite child. Right now,
I have a favorite child.
Oh, I love you. Right now, because of its versatility, I'm really enjoying brie, like a triple cream brie.
Delish. Interesting. Delish. Good.
We accept your answer.
You have many, many friends among you in the Widow Wives Club.
Okay, good. Like good.
Come join us in the Widow Wives Club. Make sure you answer all the questions. We're really not going to let you in if you don't answer all of the questions. And it makes us feel bad, so don't make us feel bad.
If you would like to join our Patreon, please consider joining at patreon.com/WWDN.
And if you don't want to join our Patreon, but you want to send us for tacos, it's buymeacoffee.com/widow. We do now. Yes, we actually eat the tacos.
And if you don't want to do that, but would like to support the podcast, please give us a rating and a review, hopefully a nice one, on Apple Podcasts and now on Spotify.
And until we talk to you again, I'm Anita.
I'm Mel.
And I'm Lisa.
And we're just three young widows, one of us who is an actual professional and pretty dang awesome, but we're okay too. And we're all just trying to figure out widow.
We
do.
This is my favorite thing to discuss with you.
Tell me, what is it?
One of my favorite things. I do enjoy tacos and cheese and dogs. This is about how you cannot pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a phone plan, especially when you're a widow, your person is dead, you might have kids, you might need another option, and you just want your phone to work, you want unlimited texting and service, and you want it to be like $25 a month.
It blows my mind that they have plans that start at $15 a month. That is so cheap. And the cool thing is it uses other 5G networks. And so you don't have to pay extra for that. And you still get great service.
Yep. Anita and I have traveled all over and I have used my phone. So I highly recommend it. And my mom's even on it. When my dad died, we put his phone down to the cheapest plan, which is $15 a month. And I think my mom's on the $20 a month plan, and it's so worth it. It's so much cheaper than what we were all paying before. So I highly recommend it if you're on a budget or not. Who cares? Ryan Reynolds is in charge of the company, and they send you free stickers with Ryan Reynolds temporary tattoos. It's kind of the best. So if somebody wants to sign up, what can they do, Anita?
Go to trymintmobile.com/WWDN. Seriously, you guys, such a great idea. Save yourself some money.
And if you're worried about losing data or having any changes with your phone, not going to happen. They walk you through it. Everything's fine. It's the easiest process of all time. Again, that's
trymintmobile.com/WWDN.